Okay, the time for our English Museum discussion weekly. We are having almost 1 hour. So we are going to start with our traditional appointed discussion or the sutta discourse. Before going to that, if anyone is having any other meditation reports or any other thing, we can take few minutes at the beginning of the discussion.
Avasarai Bhante, we have received 5 reports. These are mainly the reports we left from last couple of weeks. With your permission, I'd like to present them.
Yeah.
Report number 1, Theron Farnai, walking meditation, writing a report after a long time, started indoors in the floor, felt there is an improvement on the injured right leg toes were clutching the floor to maintain the equal firmness. And sole, the arch curvature was underneath the sole was sensed, and it was making the walking smooth. Even the right leg was experienced the tensed arch, but it was followed by a firm clutching of floor by the toes and breaking the smooth transition to the left leg. Walked outdoors on the experience a much more fluid transition from left foot to right. Mind wanted to move from this thing of vitakka on walking details to mundane things, but came back to walking. I suppose it was just eager to see how normal the sitting meditation. Sat on the floor, but not in a proper paryanka, but a comfortable posture without a strain on the knee. Mind was on mundane thoughts, but breathing. Airflow entered the nose, was not forceful, and the entry was not significantly felt. To keep the mind on it, it became a very faint sensation, and only indication of breathing was to feel the movement of the upper body in the effort taken the breathing. Stopped or automatically paused was not sure, but the breathing was started with a sensation, but again it died down, and it was an action which was devoid of any drama, and it was so boring to keep the mind on it, but could feel the neck muscles relaxing and whole self was relaxed. Much merit to you, Swami Dvansa. So that's the end of the report, Bhante.
So if I gather, that means you are recovering from leg ailment, so therefore now walking is like something novelty. So you can feel the sole, the arch, the heel, everything. So your mind is sometimes very, very in detail catching information because you are in a recovery process. But whenever it becomes normalized, mind start wandering, mundane thinking, daydreaming, and again you bring it back to the leg. But when there is a pain, mind is not wandering. Mind is always with the pain because it is pulling it into the this thing. So you must know, you must understand how to make use this drama. Whenever you are painful, mind is always with the leg. When it's a healing, mundane thoughts and wandering thoughts happen. So wandering thoughts and wandering thought is a sign of healing. So I am also suffering from my right leg. So morning when the coolness happen, very difficult to walk. So when I go into the dining hall, so I try to be aware each and every step. Whenever it is alleviated, mind start wandering, looking up and there, down there, kind of thing. So everything is something dramatic. So therefore pain is considered the Vedana Anupassana, feeling is something very, very, make your mind very immediate, very pulling into the body, but you hate it. The day you understand the ailment, the difficulty, the pain, it's a kind of an anchor, kind of a benchmark, and keep it there. Whenever healing happens, wandering happens. Whenever healing happens, mundane thoughts happen. It's also good. It's a sign of healing. So therefore, report in such a way, how to make use this pain, how to make use this mundane thoughts to facilitate mindfulness. Your report is fairly good. But I think skill, you can still develop the skillful, then your report will be very aesthetic. Very constructive, very, very positive thinking. So I wish you had to have another leg pain or ailment. That is the best way to develop your mindfulness. Okay, Ari, we are going to the next.
Yes, Bhante. Report number two. This is from India, 13 years old. Venerable Bhante.
No, during the you have to repeat. Tweet number two.
This is from Induvarada Silva, 13 years old.
Okay.
Venerable Bhante, during the walking meditation, I felt the uneven surface during the sessions. I also felt the cold breeze filling the area whilst the loud pampering dog. Later, I focused my mind perfectly towards my breathing. 12 steps without any distractions. I cleared my mind purely on my breathing again. I also observed other noises around myself, trying to just let the noises happen. That's the end of the report, Bhante.
Only on walking?
Yes, Bhante.
Yeah. So sometimes try to explain about the breathing and kind of thing. When you are walking, how do you know you are walking? That's the main thing you have to explain. How do you know you are not sitting? So pertaining to that, very little reported. So therefore, whenever walking, make sure you are not sitting, you are not lying down, you are not standing. How do you know? So then you will come to the basic main object. What is the impact on the earth? What are the touching points? So try to give that. The rest is sundry items. So main thing you have to write, being you are 13 years old, excused. But you must fill your report 80% from the direct experience, direct object, direct benchmark. Then it will be true to type, very scientific. Please continue.
Report number three, Vishmi, 13 years old, Rockhampton Satipasala. Mindful walking. In mindful walking, I found my path and began walking. I felt my feet. I felt them lifting and placing, and I felt that the air brushing past my legs was cold, and the floor was even cooler than the air. Over time, the floor felt cooler, but my feet felt a bit warmer. Sometimes I would get distracted or feel nothingness for a few minutes, but I would come back to the feet. I did mindful walking for 45. I didn't count the laps before getting distracted. Mindful sitting. In mindful sitting, I found my spot and began sitting. In the beginning, I began my feeling nothingness. After about 10 to 15 minutes, I began feeling the breath through my nose. It was a bit subtle in the beginning, but over time it became more prominent. I felt that in the beginning, in-breath and out-breath were cool, and the in-breath was cooler than the out-breath. Then, as I continued to observe, the in-breath stayed cool, but the left warmer. During the 10 to 15 minutes, I felt sleepy and noticed that my chest felt heavy and my breath felt different. I didn't fall asleep. I had a couple of thoughts. I did mindful sitting for 45 minutes and I didn't count the cycles. Gentle mindfulness. Today, for the mindful game, we started making paper lanterns. I was mindfully listening to the instructor holding the paper neatly. We didn't get to finish because we ran out of time, but we will continue it later. That's the end of the report, Bhante.
So compare this in the last report. The Vishmi is very keen to indicate when walking happened, how with the direct touch of the ground, with the sole and the touch of air, and how it become warmer and cooler. That means the changes pertaining to your surface, your leg, and the pertaining to your air or the earth. So that comparison, when you are observing, you are completely in mindfulness. So therefore, to have that, you must have fair amount of time with your primary object. But meanwhile, you have to develop the skillfulness in reporting. So this is very good. And after that, I think yesterday, yesterday I had a chance to talk with Vishmi because she presented all the other reports from the Rockhampton. They are fairly good in reporting. So not only meditation, but the reporting also very important. I try my best to keep thinking that I am correct. Maybe I am also wrong. But anyway, this is at least good for answering your question papers in the exams. Understand the question, write pertaining to your direct touch pertaining to the question, then it will be easier. Good. We are moving.
Yeah. Report number 4. This is from Onaya. Dear Bhante, I am 17 years old that usually do. However, recently I did lying down meditation and you asked me to look into it. So here's my experience. Lying down meditation. I laid down comfortably on my back and closed my eyes, and immediately my mind was flooded with thoughts. I tried to disengage with them and observe them. However, at times I unconsciously dived into my thoughts and became a part of them, which deterred me. Due to this, at times I would live in the thought and only be brought back to observing them, and when I realized that I have not been in the present, I kept getting swept up in the thoughts until I took a deep breath, and out of nowhere my body physically began to relax. Tensions that I have not known began to loosen, and it felt as if my whole body has sunk in stress. Thoughts were still running through my mind, however my body retained calm. Throughout my meditation, my mindfulness slowly shifted from my thoughts to my breath. My breath started out fast, began to deepen and slow down. With each breath, my body relaxed even more until a buzzing sense of calmness surrounded me. I stayed with this feeling for the remainder of my meditation until my alarm rang. And even when I came out of my meditation, this calm feeling remained with me. Teruvan Sarnai, Onaya. That's the end of the report, Bhante.
Yeah, that usually people feel guilty while lying down, thinking that meditation is something sitting and walking. But Pauksado was a very senior Bhante, and he has a lot of stomach problem or gastritis. He can't sit, he can't walk. So he sometimes toppling, rolling. And only he can do meditation in walking, which is so torturing. So he discussed with the people who can sit and walk and all the kind of thing. But his main experience was, under the torturing situation, lying down. So, Onaya, what you have to do is, whenever possible, do sitting and walking, because your body is very young. But daily when you go to the bed, take this opportunity. Don't consider it's not a time for mindfulness, not a time for meditation. Yes, it is time. So then you are making use of this normal day-to-day routine to add little more episode in daily lying down meditation. But whenever you need to relax in lying down, you have to excuse yourself. You have to sympathize yourself. Lying down also, another posture, why can't we use it? Why don't we use it? So, we are not recommending it for the beginners, but as you continue, it's a good diversification of your mindfulness. Good effort. We are moving.
Report number 5. Dear Bhante, I am 15 years old and have been practicing for 3 years. This is my experience. Please advise me. Recently, my sister my shoes and I got mad at her and told her she had to fix them. I tried to, however. As soon as it started to go away, I once again attached to myself to it. I did that because at the time, letting go of the anger felt like I was losing the argument. But once I reflected on it after cooling down, I realized that by letting go of the anger would not mean I lost the argument, but decided to save myself from how unnecessary the argument was. Teruvan Sarnai, this is Hasini. That's the end of the report, Bhante.
So we say, try to be like a turtle. When someone is disturbing you, when someone is irritating you, just tug in, just wait. It is not a passivity, it is not a withdrawing. And ultimately, at last you will understand, the argument is just wastage of time. You just tug in. So we have turtle societies, asking children to just to assimilate a turtle, or the plant you call, once you touch it, you'll get calmed down, Mimosa pudica, that the thorny plants. So likewise, so many people think it is a kind of a defeat. It's a kind of a withdrawal. No. So therefore, this is a good thing. So you have to now share it with others. Not to win the argument, but try to be with peace of your mind without anger. So therefore, take the turtle as a example. So you can expand as you keep on continuing with adverse, difficult people, and you are the winner. Before, it's a winning without the battle. Good. Okay, thank you, Ari.
Thank you, Bhante, for taking all the
because last few days, few weeks, I was not available for this one. That is why the accumulation. So now we can go to the... We have taken 15 minutes for that. So now I invite Venerable Buddharakis is waiting to read the sutta. So Buddharakita Amadro.
So again, we continue with this Sutta Napada. We're reading the Pasura Sutta in the chapter of 8. So I'm going to continue slightly overlapping with last week, 2 weeks ago, just to remind people where we are.
So you may give a little introduction about what does it mean by the whole Sutta, the Pasura.
Okay, so Pasura was a debater in the time of the Buddha, and he was very sharp at arguing, and he would go around and challenge people to a debate, and he would debate anything. So in the modern times, he was like one of these talk show hosts, and like have the guests on, and then they would debate about the latest goings on in the world. So something like that, or like a university debate team where you have a topic and then you would just debate about the topic. So this Pasura was very expert in arguing and debating any point. And his goal was to just defeat other people in argument. So he came to where the Buddha and his disciples were staying. And he came there because it was a big city and also because he wanted to debate. But then he finally had met his match in Venerable Sariputta, who was able to defeat his argument and show, you know, that his argument was empty or hollow or circular. And he wasn't used to this. So when this was reported back to the Buddha, then the Buddha gave this teaching about Pasura. And one should also remember that suttas are a particular time and place, so they're not a general, overly general prescription. So when we read this sutta, we shouldn't view that this is the kind of way to tackle all debaters or all such people in society, but we can learn and maybe take some general teachings from it. You know, because it was a particular time and a particular place. So anyway, we're on verse number 8. Yeah, number 8. And I'm going to just read that one because we did end with it last week or 2 weeks ago, and maybe it's just good to refresh. So the Buddha says, just as a hero nourished on the king's food comes thundering, desiring an opponent, rushes off in his direction, Sura, already in the past, there is no scope for a fight. So what he's saying here is, again, is that he's evoking this idea that a person who is a debater views themselves as a kind of a warrior or kind of a hero. And not only that, but a hero who has been nourished on king's food. So if you eat this kind of rich food of kings, then your body feels like strong or powerful, and you have the energy to go and fight the enemy. Whereas if you eat kind of normal food, you have the energy to just survive, or just get through day-to-day life. And it's not that the food is that particularly different. It's just that in the time of the Buddha, eating things like meat or so on were not so common, or people would only eat very small amounts. Whereas I suppose it would be like for us the equivalent of you eat very typical village food here, and then, I don't know, you're in America and you eat a big steak or something like that. So the idea was is that you're kind of all juiced up and that you feel very strong and powerful and you go thundering about looking for opponents, and then you hear that somebody is in such a direction and you rush off to fight them. So if you hear about, this professor or that person has such and such a theory or a view, you go and you argue with them. But the Buddha points out that one is already in the past when one does this. In other words, you're not really meeting a person and having a dialogue with the person. You're not in the present moment. You're just speaking from ideology or from past learnings or teachings. You don't treat a person as a person. You treat them as an object. And you don't really listen to what they have to say. You're just speaking through this screen of ideology or views or opinions. And for the Buddha, this is like being in the past. There's nothing present about your discussion. And you can feel this in such discussions on TV. There's a kind of a boring quality to what they have to say because they're not immediate and they're not listening to the other person. And it's not a dialogue or a discussion. It's in fact just an exchange of ammunition or artillery. I have this point, you have that point, I have this point, you have that point. And they don't, it's not like a conversation. It's just lobbing bombs at each other. So the Buddha describes this as being already in the past and that there is no scope for a fight. In other words, that one doesn't view the other person as having anything meaningful to say to them. That it's about victory, it's about zero sum, it's about I win and you lose. Whereas in real engagement, in a person who's genuinely seeking truth, then there's always a listening quality to their discussion, and they're listening to the other party, and they're taking the information and the feedback, and they're adjusting accordingly, and it's a lively discussion. And it's not a fight. And it's not about scoring points. And it's about learning and it's about elucidation of truth. Whereas if you just view the other person as somebody to be defeated and by all means necessary, then there is no learning. There's no truth in that. So the next verse is when they grasp a view and argue and asserts, this alone is true. Tell then, when a debate has arisen, there is no opponent for you there. So again, the Buddha is pointing out, and this is still a very common aspect of life today, is that when we do grasp a truth, we fail to see the other point. And as John Stuart Mill's in more recent times made famous by saying, you don't understand the argument if you can't understand your opponent's argument and be able to express it better than them back to themselves. So this should be the goal when you are in an argument or in a discussion, that you hear the other person's perspective and what they have to say or do about it, and you can articulate it back. So actually here in the monastery, I've been for many, trying to teach the children not just this approach of being like a turtle and withdrawing all the time, but actually how to have an engaged discussion with somebody. So, for instance, earlier on, we had a report about an argument over, I think, some pair of shoes being damaged by a sister. It's like rather than just arguing with the person, or rather than just withdrawing like a turtle, one issue that I have with this whole turtle approach is that it can actually be stonewalling. It's not a practice of noble silence, but it's in fact just a kind of you're not worth speaking to. So in life, I think it's the real challenge is to have an open, to have a discussion with somebody else. So what sometimes we have to do is try to use like I statements, things like I feel angry when my shoes have been damaged and destroyed. So in this way, rather than blaming the other person, like you stupid cow, you damaged my shoes, you are conveying to the other person that you're hurt, that your shoes have been damaged, and that this bothers you. So, for instance, I feel angry when my shoes have been damaged. You know, so you don't judge the other person. You just let the other person know exactly how you feel and why you feel this way. So it's a very simple statement. So we're not trying to insult the other person. We're not trying to assume we understand why they damaged the shoes. But we, you know, just convey to the other person how I feel and why I'm annoyed. So that they, you know, that we assume that they're not so stupid and that they can understand and take in that information. And we hope that they can find a way to apologize, maybe give an account for what they did and make an amends, make it up to you, to your satisfaction. And then you know you've received a full apology. So these kind of arguments and fights that we have as young children are very important learning opportunities and grounds, like where we argue and we resolve our arguments and we apologize. Later on in life, you see adults and they can't argue, they can't discuss, they can't debate. So on the one end, they don't hear the other person's point of view. And on the other end, they're... Again, I don't mean to demolish this idea of a turtle, but they're just stonewalling the other party. I mean, certainly to have the patience of a turtle, you know, to withdraw and be mindful and, you know, put a space between yourself and the argument is a very powerful thing. But ultimately, we have to not be either, have no boundaries where somebody can just smash our walls down and just walk all over us. Or on the other hand, we're just stonewalling people where we have a kind of moral superiority in like, I wouldn't even talk to that person. You can't even speak to that person. This kind of contempt and disgust is very powerful and very destructive in relationships. So we say, if we have this in our mind, this alone is true. Whenever I hear that in an argument, oh, you just do this one thing and, you know, then we can fix it. And in life, most things are not so simple and easy. Just this one thing is a complete crazy. Whenever you hear this one thing, then you know you know that this person's a bit crazy or extreme. Only fanatics see one thing and only fanatics see things in black and white. So this kind of black and white thinking is very symptomatic of people with mental illness. It's called splitting in psychology. So when everything is splitting, when everything is black and white, when everything is just one thing, then you know you're dealing with somebody who's a bit crazy. Because life is a middle way and life is very multifaceted, very multi-spectrum. So there is no this one way. And it's a very crazy. So in Buddhism, we love to have this ekaya no passa, where we have just this one path. But be very careful of this one path argument, because we will alienate other people and not bring them onto that one path. So we need to be very careful about being a crazy person with this one truth. And only I know this one truth and you know wrongly. This is very argumentative and frictive and not going to help elucidate truth. It might win you a point in a battle or in a debate, but life is not all battles and debates, and we can really lose the middle ground. So when a debate has arisen, there is no opponent for you there. Like the Buddha is again emphasizing this point. In a debate, you don't have an opponent when you just view that this alone is true, because you've taken the morally superior or intellectually superior ground and you just want to smash down the enemy and just bulldoze all over them. And okay, you win the argument, you win the debate, but you've lost the war. You know, so we need to be very careful, as he mentioned in a previous sutta or a previous stanza, that there is no scope. What does he say again? Sorry, I'm looking back into the earlier sections to see. Like the Buddha says that there's a time for a debate and there's a time to leave a debate behind. Because even if one sees how one can kill off one's enemy in the debate, one shouldn't strike that killer blow because one will lose the overall battle. You know, because you will have humiliated the other person or put them down so much that they feel angry and they'll feel resentful and they'll come back and get you again. So it'll end up like a skirmish or a small fight will become a war. So, for instance, at the moment we have this issue in the Ukraine, and the Americans are hostile towards Putin, and Putin is hostile towards the Europeans, and this is a very dangerous situation because a lot of ego is being elevated, and it becomes very difficult for people to back down or to find a middle ground or to have a more colored perspective. And it becomes very simple, like in the debating world, like who's the winner and who's the loser. But in life, everybody's losing if there's a war. Wars are very, very expensive and everybody's going to lose. But anyway, maybe we can hear from Mahatero on what he has to say about these last two verses.
Yeah, you made a point out of the turtle. I was worrying about that. I wanted to hit you. Oh, yeah, the turtle is whenever someone has broken your shoes, first you have to get a distance. Otherwise, if you go to the fight without preparing ammunition, you are the loser. First, you have to understand the situation, withdraw. And then once you are recuperated and ready, then you can say, I'm sorry, I am disturbed due to your action. Or your action, or whatever may be, because you distorted my shoes, I am disturbed. So you got that, you get that understanding due to the space. That space is the best. That is the winning. And therefore, becoming a turtle is not callous. It is not withdrawing. It is a must. In between argument happens, just you take a little rest. And within that you understand not to hurt him, but to give a retaliation, not a retaliation, give an answer, telling that I am disturbed. That you indicate you are not to provoking it, so all kind of thing. The other person get a psychological chance and understanding. Just as he is expressing, he is not callous, he is not dead, and he is not blind, he is not deaf. He is disturbed. So other person may say, it was because of my action, or he is not callous, he is giving some kind of a response. So that thought moment of that, getting a distance with the pain, getting a distance with this thing is the secret. So therefore don't look down turtle. Turtle is a must. And I am opposite. I am always go and fight and argue and kind of thing. But late I found, no. You have to understand who the opponent, what is the way of argumenting, and what are the ammunition and equipments I have. So everything happened within a split second. It don't take much. And then you are prepared.
Well, like I, in my behavior, I felt I was like a turtle. I wasn't particularly bothered about what you had to say.
No, yesterday evening we had a long talking. I learned, and I like if you can give a little briefing about. We were talking about, I'm taking the argument, complete the discussion to the different track, how to prevent from the people taking drugs, not to rehabilitating. So,
okay.
Wait till you. And they told, I am very skillful in rehabilitating drug addicts. Not myself, I mean, our team. And then United Nations is asking, what is your strategy to prevention rather than curative and rehabilitation? So the idea came while he was massaging me. So I asked them to shut mouth and wait. And I told him, you see, I have a question. I have this thing. My mind is not working. What is the preventative way? He told S. Aggressive childhood experience. Adverse. So I thought he's talking nonsense. That what he's talking about, this childhood experience and these drugs. And somehow or the other, he gave me the idea. Immediately I crossed the mind. My module is talking about these 10 points, and he was also referring to the 10 points. I chased him out and wrote a message to the person, this is the way. Now we have to turn our argument to the prevention rather than cure, through mindfulness, through the drug addicts. The distance solace is S. So I did not study. He put a chit on my computer. This is the way other point, Bande. You can find that information about the adverse childhood experience. So it's not something alien to me because I am a jolly good child when I was. And I'm a child of the whole community. No one is pressing me. And I was in a blooming. So he is coming from the very unfortunate, very dull climate. So we two are fighting always. So I wrote according to my understanding. And next day morning, we had only 48 hours. Rushing like. Then I told, I am not. I gave my idea. You have your argument. And they had four, five, Zoom meetings. We consulted everyone. And they told, this idea is bright. So not to have drug addiction or that kind of aberrative mental situation, you must have a good childhood experience. But no one is having on the earth. Everyone is having. And 10 points. I am not contenting my thing to the 10 points, but it's a very good set. And he told he had 7 adverse situations. So I remembered, I am happy to say no. I also would have gone through. But it was not much making impact. So ultimately yesterday morning we prepared the paper. And yesterday I raised the point. And he came with his information, ammunition. And he told me these are the universally accepted 10 points. And exactly the same thing I also learned. And we had a healthy and unhealthy argument and fighting and all the kind of thing. So I am learning because I am so happy to say I am a very happy child. But I also would have gone through, but not looking at from that lens. So I have to now study what are the adverse experiences at my childhood. So it's a kind of a Western thinking. For Eastern thinking, we call it a karmic force. You are born to the bad children, bad parents, and the bad atmosphere. And he is not happy with the whole everything to the karmic forces. Partly he is angry. And Western people, they put them down 10 points. But this talk I listen is a Sri Lankan person. He was taken from the same 10 points. And he says, even in Sri Lanka, even in the remote areas, these situations are happening. And Venerable Dhammasagara was doing rehabilitation programs, 3 programs in Gaul with the probation houses for the children, rehabilitation. People, those who suffered, put into the camp and they are giving rehabilitation, probation houses. Am I correct? So now they are giving mindfulness. And the chief officer says, Bhante, please help me, because the probation officers are screwing children. Very common. I told, this is the filthy society, this is the filthy, the civilization. This is what the hell I am being suffered from the parents or something else. Now I am put into the probation houses, 10 feet wall, big wall, and these officers coming and screwing them. So what the torturing thing? And lucky enough, we have an access to these children through mindfulness. So we are learning, being monks, what a kind of a world. So yesterday we had that kind of, so we are not very friendly, but we are fighting, but we are learning, we are dialogue, we are in an argument. So would you like to comment on that? Not like on turtle, please.
So again, if you look at drugs, there's two main types of drugs, happy drugs and numbing drugs, or dull dull drug. So alcohol is a drug, you take it and you feel happy for a while and then you feel numb or puts you to sleep. So somebody I know, he describes drugs as uppers or downers, basically two classes. So if you've had a lot of suffering in your life, you either want to have an up experience or a down experience. It's like splitting Vedana into just good experiences or numb experiences, numb rather than bad experiences. So supposing you've had a difficult time, difficult life, you want to go out and party, you want to have a good time. So you take the happy drugs, or you go and you don't feel happy in a happy place, and then you feel there's something wrong with you. So you take a downer, you take a kind of a number, and you put yourself to sleep. So all the time I've run across this in meditation, where people want to have good experiences in meditation, they want happy drug, or they want numb drug, they want to go to sleep. So again, as Venerable Dhammajiva just mentioned, about children who have grown up in maybe dysfunctional families, dysfunctional communities, and they end up getting put into court, and then they end up in these camps, and then they end up being abused again in these camps. And you can say it in a way it's karmic, where they have these, you know, unfortunate situations. And as Venerable Dhammajiva mentioned, you know, certainly from my listening to his biography, he's had a kind of he likes to paint a picture of a very idyllic situation. But, you know, sometimes we can forget. The mind is very capable of forgetting very difficult situations. In fact, it's like a safety mechanism. When we're young, we can experience difficulty and then we block it out. So this is like the numbing drugs, the downers. We forget. You know, there's a happiness, a bliss of forgetting as well. So this is one of the reasons, though, that I'm sort of cautious around this idea of the turtle, because I do notice within Sri Lankan society that there can be a tendency for difficulty to happen, and then we just dismiss or diminish that such a person has suffered or had a difficult time, or just say, oh, we all have difficulties. But sometimes it's a failure of imagination to understand that some people have more difficulties than other people, and some people can have very fortunate circumstances. So, for instance, I often say to, you know, whenever I hear Sri Lankan people complaining in the modern time about, oh, you know, the government is terrible and the economic situation is terrible. Well, I've been coming to Sri Lanka for more than 25 years now, and no way is it worse now than it was in the 90s. So I was sort of trying to share my outsider perspective with Venerable Dhammajiva that the past here in Sri Lanka was not necessarily better than the present time. And I wasn't here in the 1970s when Venerable Dhammajiva, or in the 1960s when Venerable Dhammajiva has wonderful memories. But as far as I know from the history, there was people like the JVP and the Black Tigers and a lot of assassinations and killings happening, and it wasn't a very pleasant time. 35 years of civil war is not a pleasant time. So I'm a big fan of like fairly peaceful circumstances and situations. And as I mentioned earlier on, war is a very expensive thing. And sometimes people who have never experienced war or difficulties like that have no imagination or no idea of how tremendous the suffering is for the people in the front line. And I've experienced that here in Sri Lanka. I've been a witness to mass murders here. And, you know, I've really seen terrible things. And that here in this time, and also in Ireland itself as well, in Northern Ireland, we've had tremendous sectarian violence. And, you know, when I go and visit these days and I don't even see the apparatus of security around anymore, the police checkpoints and all that, I don't get tired of that. You know, I can just be in a plain patch of road where there used to be security in the past, or even here, you know, certain parts of Colombo, I go around and I still can't forget the police barricades and blockades and all this kind of thing. And now that they're all gone, you know, I it's like magic. I still feel the magic of going through certain parts of Colombo and remembering that the security is gone. I don't forget that, you know, as a witness of this country. And there was a long time where I found it very dull and not interesting, or I found Colombo a very draining place, whereas now it's not so bad. You know, I can go into Colombo and I feel okay about it, whereas in the past it was a bummer, you know. It was draining and tiring, and because I would have memories of just all the security and all of the stupid blocks and all this kind of thing and the amount of time. You know, now it's traffic jam. You're stuck in a traffic jam, but I'm enjoying the traffic jam. Before, I would be stuck in police blockades and all this kind of stupid stuff, and potholes on the road and all this rubbish everywhere. And it was just terrible. And, you know, so I can never get excited when Venerable Dhammajiva talks about how good it was in the old days. I just think it's very deluded. So we argue about these points. And so this idea of the turtle is to me, yeah, okay, don't be hostile and don't be combative and always arguing the point and frictive. But at the same time, don't be a doormat and having people bulldoze all over you. And it takes a certain skill. So as I mentioned earlier on, like one can say to another person, look, I feel angry when my shoes have been destroyed, and just leave it there and let the information settle in and go on. You've made your point, you know. So this whole thing about drugs is like, we have to be a little bit understanding. It's not people take drugs because they're completely foolish. Sometimes they are taking it as a medicine and trying to feel normal in their life and trying to feel good, or they're trying to just simply forget about the tremendous suffering that they have had and experienced in their life, and that they need skillful tools to help them to recover. And so it's very nice. The question that Venerable Dhammajiva was being asked by the UN was, you know, are there preventative measures that we can take for drug addiction? And I said to him, you need to understand, like, who do we need to target if you want prevention? The people that we really need to prevent from getting onto drugs are those who have experienced adverse childhood experiences. So these adverse childhood experiences are things like we've mentioned, like, for instance, extreme financial deprivation. So people who grow up in extreme poverty, where they're constantly tortured by the lack of food, the lack of money, the, you know, the impoverishment, especially when they can see that other people are not having it as hard as they are, then they can feel inferior or oppressed. And another kind of adverse childhood experience is where, for instance, somebody within their family has, for instance, died, particularly by violence or by suicide or something like that. Then this can be very impactful on people, especially children, where they don't know why somebody was injured. They don't know why they died, or it's kept a secret. It's kept a mystery from them. It's something not to be spoken about. Again, maybe I overreact to this idea of the turtle. Like, I see it in a different way. You know, this idea of the turtle is a very skillful thing. You know, it's not just a dumb turtle. Like, the dumb turtle is like a stone and locks away all the time. You know, how to grieve. Like, children need to be taught how to grieve. Like, in the West these days, somebody dies in the family, they cannot show them the body. Oh, you know, mummy is sleeping. No, mummy is dead. You know, and we need to discuss how, you know, how to help and support the children and the family in that time, especially these days in the West, where they don't have extended family or community around the so-called nuclear family. It can really be super impactful and greatly affect the children. And, you know, like, the next week they're sent back to school and told, you know, just continue as normal when their life has been turned upside down. Another example of an adverse childhood experience is like where they experience violence, meaning like they see like one parent fighting with another parent, being, you know, this kind of heavy argument and fighting that can go on, or with somebody who they call a caregiver. So we'll say a grandparent. So supposing somebody is a family member or something like that is oppressing another member. In Australia, they use this language to put the other person down, you know, to be stood over. So when children see caregivers being stood over and that they feel powerless to do anything about it, again, this is a very powerful adverse childhood experience, especially when it's chronic, when it's like all the time. You know, they come back and all the time one parent is oppressing another parent, or their parent is being oppressed, we'll just say, by gangsters or by people in the neighborhood, being bullied. You know, that powerlessness that they can't do anything about it is also very, very damaging. And, you know, again, because of civil, what you call it, like warfare, like here in Sri Lanka, there was a civil war, 35 years. There was a lot of abuse, a lot of victimization, and it can be very local. You know, in certain towns or villages here, there was tremendous fighting and war. And then the next village over, nothing. And, you know, people can be quite callous. Like, I've experienced that where I was in a house that was flooded. I was living in Malaysia and the house was flooded. And the next street over, nothing, because it was just on higher ground. And, you know, it was the difference between what we were experiencing and the next house over, the next street over, was day and night. And it was just, it's a failure of imagination to appreciate how much suffering can happen just in your next street. And it takes a certain empathy and imagination and an openness and a kind of a trust in oneself to even imagine how dark a place it can be for, like, we'll just say, somebody in the next street. It's just amazing how life can serve you these cards. And, you know, it can be very callous here in Sri Lanka, where people just go, oh, it's just your bad karma, you know, suck it up. You know, and it's like, you know, it's really callous and really stupid. And then you wonder why people are on drugs. And then they, you know, they're on drugs to take it as a medicine in many cases. And then they have no counseling and no, for instance, here, it's not very common to have AA meetings or other kinds of support group meetings where people who take drugs can meet other people who take drugs and they can talk to each other about their experience and then how to get out of that experience. So unless we change the supporting conditions, they will continue to take drugs. If we change the supporting conditions around that, give them proper treatment down into the root causes, then we give them an opportunity to help themselves and get out of the difficult situations life has given them. So in many ways, you know, Sri Lanka is a wonderful place to live. There's good community and good supports, but there's also a dark side at times, you know, where people can be callous towards the experience of people in the next street over. Anyway, that's some ideas.
Anyone to express?
Excuse me, Swaminathan. I just listening to both of the conversations going on with between the two venerables, and just my thought on it was just that you know, both sides are important, but it seems like things are getting to the point now with drugs and abuse and so forth of people that there does need to be some empathy and listening, because there's so much suffering that people have going on in their minds. But at the same time, there's got to be a change of, like, being able to not react and be mindful, and is very important. But and then, so I just see both sides being important. I think Thich Nhat Hanh really got a good, you know, kind of mixed his teachings with empathetic listening to both sides of, you know, conflicts, because there are so many conflicts now in the world. And so that being a very important part is in what you're saying, Buddha Rakhi, excuse me, Swaminansa, what you're saying about empathetic listening, and very important to try to get the person out of their trap in their mind. They're kind of caught in some kind of self-deluding stories that are created from childhood. They become abused, and then they think the world is just like that, and they go through life deluded and trapped. So there has to be some kind of way to get that person out of that before they actually can be mindful, maybe. Because, you know, if they're mindful and not able, still not functioning right, and don't understand how to be a healthy person, then it might not be too helpful. So that was just my thought on.
I too see now present day more than specific techniques. We use the common techniques of mindfulness for everything. So that's a kind of a trend in the present day crisis. And unspoken sources, those who were mindful and they had no chance for their views, now it is happening. That's also happening through the very bright and very media people says, why don't you give a chance to prayer, mindfulness and meditation? So we must be ready to express ourselves. We have nothing to argue. We have practiced in such a way, and I am only happy. Of course, it's a very dark, damn situation. Happiness is, they are now consulting mindfulness. So I was waiting for 40 years. Why don't these people are not taking mindfulness as a preventative? Of course, it started with the curative. So Pandita Sayadaw passed away. With that idea, he will thought never the West will understand the way I thought, the preventative way of mindfulness. It was a business mindfulness, business Buddhism. Now, the climate crisis, drugs, and education reform, now they are slowly, slowly coming to the mindfulness. Still not the traditional way of mindfulness, what we are taught as monks. So now I have to learn Western mindfulness. They are using them for curative, therapeutic, and it's a pandemic. It is contagious, and it is Mac mindfulness. So I was accused so far, why I am so fond of Mac mindfulness? Because it increased my vocabulary. It increased my shades of mindfulness and exposed to you people. Otherwise, I would have inside the cave and meditating on the mindfulness. I don't know what the mindfulness is. At least we have to start with the therapeutic. Curative, because it's a dynamic, it's dramatic. But we know it is another drug. But when you go to the preventative, the mindfulness is having that character. It is very callous. It's very turtle-like. Just wait. And the forefront line is therapeutic line. Preventative, not the preventative. So it is our duty to take the people's attention and the attraction to the therapy and the curative and say, hey, darling, mindfulness is not only that. We have a preventative. Now UN is asking me or Satipasala, why don't you do preventative? I have never thought. Even though that was my main duty, it was my main purpose, because I have no vocabulary. I don't have the adverse childhood this thing as the proper answer. By discussing and kind of things. The moment it came, I am not an expert to talk about the adverse childhood experience because I am talking only Sadhu side. Very happy situation, and he was, of course, we were fighting. There's no bloodshed, but fighting, and I learned. So I had to hit him and tell him, don't talk naughty. Just see, don't look at the bad thing, then there you have to behave like a blind person. Don't listen to the bad thing, behave like a dumb. But you are absorbing, you are not reacting. Whenever they are ready to accept the preventative, okay, you must go very gracefully and say, I'm very thank you. Situation is very grave. It's very damn. But lucky enough, you are now looking forward to see the mindfulness as the preventative. What a silver line on the dark cloud. So in the climatic situation also, I am not an expert. But I am the coach, I told. You all are talking with very sober mind and climate is disturbed. I am not. And so happy after 40 years, lucky enough you are consulting mindfulness. I never dreamt even. So therefore our little circle here and the big circle in the UN and the kind of the exactly kind of a turning point. People tested all other things and now that's the one and the only way. So I just wanted to ask Richard Davidson, because when he was talking to the Sarvodaya, this thing, he made a very foolish statement. Very clear. I have concrete. And then I know it is wrong. Because mindfulness itself is plasticity. Mindfulness is not a chair, it's a chip. Not only the neuroplasticity, mindfulness is evolving. They having the mindfulness is in the frame. I also started with that. So people say, I am cheating. I'm not defining mindfulness. I told them, you can't define. It's a dynamic thing. Dialectic. So while discussing and while arguing and kind of thing on the mindfulness becomes slowly. So whenever someone is defining mindfulness, I think he is rotten. We are empowered with the mindfulness as going on at the beginning, therapeutic, and come to the preventative, but the preventative is the core. It's a turtle. But the therapeutic is dynamic and you have to go to the field and all the kind of thing. Okay, your chance. You have anything? No. Yeah, only little time. Only you can give a chance.
No. I can ask from my practice to walking meditation. In my home, I practice walking meditation very easy speed, very slow. And then I see people very fastly, very high speed. If I go fast speed, I don't feeling my feet, too easy, I feeling every finger too fastly, not. What I practice, easy or fastly?
Ask your body. What is your body knowledge? Ask whether to go slow or go fast. You must not ask me. You ask your body what is the comfort. That's called body knowledge. So don't follow what others doing. You do both. You see other people are rushing. So you can see which one is promoting your mindfulness. Not the comfort. Don't get carried away by the comfort and the calmness. No, that is not mindfulness. Which one make you vigilant? Which one make you diligent? Which one make you in the present moment? So that will give the diversification of the mindfulness rather than your calmness and all the kind of stuff. So I have to always keep the calmness and the concentration and kind of thing is a separate issue. But the alertness to the present moment make you are vigilant. Make you are diligent, so it is very dynamic. So as far as you are asking, you are copying something. But you know the technique, you know the fast walking and slow walking, why don't you experiment yourself? You may find the equilibrium, and that day don't tell others, don't do that. Ask them to do their experiment and say, I also had the same problem, but I found peace in between, so I can't say fast walking is bad or good, you have to do and you have to put yourself into the field and say, and you are sharing with, but you are not professing. And Upanishad said, when he's walking, like an army soldier. And Burmese monks, when they are walking, they're walking fast and shouting and kind of thing. So I also was, but usually I am, and normally I am fast walking. So when they are slow walking, Achancha, so that he's asking the master, what happened to these people? They are imitating. They are like the bird called crane? Yeah, to catch the fish. So ask them to get healed. So it is for me. I am at that time. So some people walk, you can see each and every footprint. They have done 3 hours, you can see the track. But they are not raising the leg. Like a bulldozer kind of thing. So experiment and do as you like. So next day, your chance, that today is not time up. Be prepared for argumenting, not to be callous. Thank you very much for the participation. That's the end of the hour, today's session. Kamami, kamami, kamami kamitabbam.